have you heard the term second matrix? Have you heard me using that term?
Yeah, I have actually.
It came from, like, you remember when Matrix Reloaded came out, and there was those terrible scenes in Zion, and there was this rumor on the internet that actually it was a second Matrix, and that Zion was just a computer program, and that in the third movie we'd find this out. Did you catch that rumor?
I did not. I was big in the Matrix community online. I was friends with a lot of those people because they were fans of the Yong's Hat series. Right. And I was big friends with those people. And then when the second one came out, a lot of those people were very, like I was, basically said, "Ooh, Hollywood got its fingers all over the story." And just kind of like shut it off. But, I do get the concept because, what was it? 13th floor? Right. Was that the other? Wasn't there a second Matrix in that? Wasn't there a construct within the construct?
And a third and a fourth, I think.
Yeah.
He just kept waking up into a new one. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's a very elementary idea for, Philip K. Dick narratives, and it seemed like there were clues in Matrix Reloaded, because the way that the Elder or whoever it was talking about how they relied on machines in Zion and yada yada yada. Anyway, it gave me a vain seed of hope, really, that the third one might at least have some surprises in it.
Yeah, me too. I fell for that, and I went to see the third one.
But anyway, yeah, that was where the idea came from, it's been my experience, Joseph, in the last year or so, like really becoming fully engaged with this community of podcasters and bloggers and all the rest of it, and Red Ice is particularly prevalent kind of disseminator of information, I would say, for the creation and maintenance of what I've called the second matrix, which is people who are waking up through alternate sources of information, alternate media, but because of this configuration of the psyche, which has already created, the original sort of infrastructure of consensus reality and corporate media and all the rest of it. Because we're bringing to this new information and these new perspectives that same tendency to want to coagulate realities into a sort of rational narrative, then people they're tending not to see this as a process. They're seeing it more as an end. So it's like, the world isn't what I thought it was. It's what David Icke says it is. It's what Alex Jones says it is. It's what Red Ice Creation says it is. It's what Aeolus Kephas says it is. And so then there reminds me of something in Castaneda, which Don Juan says to Carlos, which is that the sorcerer's path is a dead end. But it's necessary for the apprentice, because he's locked into this very fixed view of reality, his assemblage point is stuck in this place of consensus reality, it's necessary for him to be given an alternate perception, a separate reality, to experience a whole other reality in order to realize that what he thought was reality was just a position of the assemblage point, was just a perspective and an interpretation, of formless energy coagulated into a form, into a narrative, and then fixed, and then that becomes an all-inclusive reality that there's no escaping from. So then, by training as a sorcerer and entering into the sorcerer's world, then the apprentice is able to, if he's sophisticated enough or flexible enough, is able to see, oh, wait a minute, that was just an interpretation. So this is just an interpretation too, and then the trick is to weasel between the two into a neutral place of non-interpreted reality, whatever the hell that might be. So that's kind of what I've been wrestling was, like being part of this community and doing my transmedia storytelling and realizing that I was taking my position as one of the architects of the second matrix. And the ambivalence I experienced about that, and that because this wasn't a reality tunnel that I wanted to live in either, you know, not just because there were female camps and black helicopters either, not just because it was primarily negative, but just because it was so nuts and bolts and so literal minded and just kind of so informed by the same kind of tendencies that had already constricted and suffocated me within consensus reality, again, like the environmental movement with all these egos battling to be somebody. So then my process, that's how my process of transmedia storytelling has become more and more personal, because I've been just bringing it more and more down to my own story. What's my own story? How can I uncover the hidden agendas, the kind of complex, sophisticated conspiracy of my own life that's actually kept me in the dark, never mind all that big picture stuff. So that's been my process, and that's kind of where I'm at now, like not really knowing what's going on out there and not really caring, because it doesn't seem very relevant. And the reason I'm kind of gone on this tangent is because while you were talking about that 2%, I kept thinking of Second Matrix, you know, Second Matrix. This is those 2%, yes, they are seeing that the ship is sinking, and so they're getting in their life rafts, but as soon as they get to the island, they'll just build it up all over again, because they're taking that virus with them. And if this is true, then the reason, I think, is because the people you're talking about, yes, they've been able to wake up to the corruption of corporations, and they're willing to look at the fact that the system is fucked, but they're not actually willing to look at why, I think. Because this is what I've been banging my head against in my own work, is that people don't want to hear about personal stuff. They don't want to look at their personal unconscious. And that seems to be actually what is really behind the environmental crisis, what's really behind the political crisis, the economic crisis, behind everything, as I see it, is that collective, disowned shadow. All of that unconscious matter that as individuals and collectively we've refused to look at over generations and generations. And so until people as individuals are actually willing to go in there and get their hands dirty into this totally non-glamorous, you know, There's no credit, there's no sense of accomplishment, there's no kudos in doing it. It's just dirty work, you know. It's just like the gathering of the lead, so you take it off into your lonely little laboratory and see if you can get some gold out of that.
Well, I believe, you know, that the things that you're saying, I agree with. But let's widen the lens a little bit. So, as above, so below. Right. So if you look at the lessons that we're talking about learning in our lifetime, then that's one application. But if you look at it over the spectrum of human history, this is a different, you know, then you have a different perspective on it. So, yes, obviously the people are going to get on the rafts. They're going to go to the island and they're going to build another matrix. We were talking about that before. You know, it comes up, the things, we build them up, they fall down. We build them up, they fall down. There's that period between build up where there's this wonderful creativity and openness and experimentation that goes on. And these are the moments that I live for. But I'm thinking about human history, and I'm putting an analogy to it, which you brought to mind by bringing up the Don Juan thing, the sorcerer's, you know, the sorcerer's path is a dead end. Mm. When I was working through a couple of different magical orders, which I won't name, I suddenly came to the realization that, for me at least, the purpose of going through that magical order was to go through it, mm. not to stay in it and be a bureaucrat.
Right.
And I passed a lot of people in the Order who, you know, their entire purpose in being in it was either to hold some position of power mm-hmm. or to be some sort of mid-level management.
Mm-hmm.
And that was their whole purpose in going through the Order. Whereas, you know, what I discovered as I shot out the other end was that my purpose in going through the Order was, just like Don Juan said, you know, was to initiate me out of a state of being. That's really all it was for, so I could move on to the next thing. And then, you know, after I kind of dropped it all together and said, you know, I've been through a couple of magical orders, I think I've learned what I need to learn, which is not to say that I can recite every, you know, spell and you know, do every incantation and do every ritual by heart. Some of them I can, but that's not what I was there to learn. What I was there to learn was, you know, I had to grok something about magical orders and coming out of certain states of being and other states of being. And then when I started working with Alan, Christopher Hyatt, and we were working on the Extreme Individual Institute, and I got really into the undoing process. And when I have the benefit of a little age behind me, which that helps, I have the perspective of looking back and realizing that my life is a series of awakenings. There wasn't one. And I definitely have not gone through the last one, but it's like a flower that continually is blooming. More petals open up, and more petals open up, and that's what, you know, my awakening process has been like. And I think human history, if you look at it that way, it's this series of awakenings that hopefully, as I said, during that period of time when we're between structures and it's the beautiful chaos, we have the option of going, you know, lots of different ways. I mean, the bifurcation point allows you to go any way you want to, actually, until it's actually bifurcated.
Mm.
We have the possibility is there. It's a possibility wave at that point. Like quantum physics talks about possibility waves. Until something is in a state, it's in a state of possibility wave. It's, you know, one of the ones that people know best about that is the Schrodinger's cat, you know, paradox.
Right.
But until you open the box and observe the cat is both alive and dead. Until we actually open that box and observe the cat, you know, the cat has an option of being many different things.
Mm.
And so that's kind of where I feel we're on the cusp of right now. And as much as I know that we could turn that into a totalitarian state, we could also turn it into something else.
So is it more a case of you wanting to have a say about which reality you end up in?
No. I'm just going by my intuition, and my intuition is telling me that there's a period of freedom and excitement just ahead.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I'm going by.
But what I was getting at was whether you see it as, because you would have a vested interest in ending up, you know, in a more free and bountiful future than in a totalitarian future, you know, having your brains fried in a concentration camp. Obviously, so far as you've got any personal interest, that's going to kick in at that point between the two realities. So what I was getting at was, do you see it, like, intellectually or intuitively as the being a bivocation or a split in reality, and you get to have some say in which reality tunnel you end up in, which parallel universe? Or do you see it as that what you do might determine the outcome for everybody, that there's just one reality but it's undetermined which way it's going to play out?
Yeah, I think it's undetermined. I don't know that I have any say in it, and I don't know that, honestly, I'm prepared for either. And all things in between. I'm prepared for either, but I'm excited by some of the possibilities that I foresee happening.
Mm-hmm.
But like I said, I'm not emotionally married to the fact that it may not go that way. If it doesn't go that way, I'm not going to be devastated. I will take proper action according to however way I see it going. And again, we're talking about, you know, looking two steps ahead. I'm not talking about what's happening right now. I'm talking about what I see happening and what I intuit happening in the next two steps.
Right.
But I do get a strong feeling that there will, at least for a period of time, be like, you know, this open period of experimentation where we get to play around with different states of being. And that, you know, to me, that's not a bad thing. I think that's a good thing.
But when you talked about awakening, a series of awakenings in history, I was wondering, this may be another area that we differ, because I don't really see history as anything but a downward curve. I don't see any evidence of awakening throughout history.
Really?
Right. I mean, I would say I'm not one of these romanticists about ancient Egypt either. I used to be, rather, but
that was a pretty brutal society, actually.
Right. But I mean, I would still say that more intuitively than intellectually, because I don't actually know enough about ancient Egypt. I tend to gather what data I need and then spin my own narrative based on that. But my narrative about ancient Egypt, which I included in Homo sapiens, is that it, although history, you know, the part of the period of ancient Egypt that's recorded by history, it was already on the decline, and hence they were keeping records. It's still, even that period was more in tune with reality than anything since then, I would say. So I would say that we've been getting less and less in tune with reality over the past 7,000 years, and we're now pretty much at the nadir. I like to think that we're at the nadir. That's actually my optimism, you see. The worse things get, the more optimistic I feel. Because I see it as like this alchemical process where we just have to go all the way in to the basis point of matter, you know, the deepest recesses of hell of our own unconscious, before we can begin the return journey, bringing that awareness, that recognition of our own darkness back into the light. See that? I experienced that individually in my life, as I'm sure you do too, but I also perceive it happening for the species.
No, I think we're saying the same thing. I think that what I see as a progression is, or a series of awakenings, is that we do really dumb things for a while, and then they lead to the ultimate conclusion of those things blowing up in our face collectively.
Right.
And then we go, okay, let's do this slightly different, which doesn't mean let's do it right this time. It means let's do it, you know, let's try something else.
Mm-hmm. But doesn't it get worse and darker? I mean, isn't Nazi Germany like the most extreme sort of enactment of the disowned shadow?
I'm sure there's been things that have been, you know, just as bad in the past. There's always been armies marching against other armies for the pure purpose of genocide.
Well, sure. But, I mean, in terms of individual acts of barbarism, yeah. But in terms of a global sort of spectacle, Nazi Germany has to be the pinnacle, really, doesn't it?
So far.
Right.
Which is not to say that we won't top it.
Well, that's what I was getting at, you see, because I don't see any evidence that as a species, or even like looking at individuals, we've got any closer to owning our own shit. To owning our own shadow, to really looking at our patterns. It doesn't seem like, I mean, Germany, Nazi Germany is a perfect example, because the only kind of historical narrative about that is, ooh, look how evil Hitler was, what a bastard, those poor Jews. There's no integration happening there, is there?
Well, if you look at it from a bigger perspective, though, I mean, and you know this, I mean, when you go through kind of an undoing process, it's not a one-day thing. It's this continuous regurgitation of things that come up that some of it you didn't even know was in there. Most of it you probably didn't, I would say.
Right.
And some of it is vile, vile shit that comes out of you,
mm-hmm.
That you didn't know was even embedded in there. And if you map that to humanity and look at it as some sort of global cathartic process that we've been going through,
mm-hmm.
Yes, we do get darker. We seem to have some dark moments that get really dark sometimes, but we also have some moments that, you know, that seem very liberating and uplifting. You know, I mean, I see just as much good as I see bad, and that's why I'm not completely disheartened by the fact that, yes, there is some, you know, black vile shit that comes pouring out of this planet, out of humanity sometimes. Mm. But because I see just as much beauty and creativity coming out of humanity at the same time.
I guess I have a harder time seeing that, and yet it's not that I want to see it either. It's not like I think, oh God, why can't humans be more loving and beautiful? I don't. All I think is that I wish, why can't people look at and own that vile ugliness? That would seem to be the necessary prerequisite for any sort of manifestation of beauty.
Yeah, and that's part of it too. And I think that, as first of all, it's got to be in your face to acknowledge it. Mm. You have to be conscious of its existence. Mm-hmm. And just because, Nazi Germany happened, to us, you and I sitting here speaking relatively a long time ago, but in the history of humanity, it just happened yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you think about some of the things that when you've gone through an undoing process, and I know for me, some of the things that have come out have taken me literally sometimes a couple of years to integrate and figure out what it was, where it came from, and then therefore put it in a context so that I could acknowledge it.
Right.
Because if this thing just comes crawling out of you sometimes, you're just like, that wasn't me. What the fuck was that? When in fact it was you. But you have to get context to it so that you can own it. Because if you're disassociated from it, if it's just this, traumatic thing that feels like it's an alien that crawled out of you, you're not acknowledging it and you're not owning it. And I think with something like Nazi Germany or Darfur or any of the things that we can point to, we can say that we haven't fully owned those things yet. You're right.
But we haven't even started to, is what I'm saying. Because there hasn't been any movement towards that. Instead, we've got the state of Israel acting like Nazis.
Well, again, as you know, like I said, there's this period of time where you can do things like that. As an individual, I see people do stuff like that, and if they acknowledge it at all, it takes a long time for them to acknowledge it. If they acknowledge it at all, not everybody does.
Mm. Yeah,
there's no guarantee that that there's some goal that we're going towards as a race, as a species, that we're going to be fully integrated individuals, and all this kind of stuff. There's no guarantee of that, and there's no evidence of that.
No.
But I think on an individual level, there are some people who are making headway, and some people that seem to be working towards becoming more integrated and more aware and in full ownership, or not in full ownership, in more of a state of ownership of some of their shit.
Well, that sounds like a good segue to the Extreme Individual Incident Institute, you think?
Sure.
So, because particularly the passage that I found online about the psychopath, I'll just read it so that we have some context. In the most of the world, psychopaths have gotten a bad rap. That, of course, is quite understandable, since almost all of the world's religious and social philosophies have little use for the individual except as a tool to be placed in service to their notion of something else, God or the collective or the higher good or some other equally undefinable term. Only rarely, such as in Zen, in Ayn Rand's philosophy of objectivism, in some aspects of Tibetan Buddhism and Hinduism, and in some schools of existentialism, is the individual considered primal. Here, finally, is a group which celebrates, encourages, and educates the best part of ourselves, the psychopath. Would you care to qualify that in any way?
Sure, I will. That was first of all not written by me. That was written by Dr. Christopher Hyatt, aka Alan Miller, who's now deceased, RIP. I'm going to admit something on your show that I haven't publicly admitted before.
Cool.
Which is back in the day when EII started, that's what we refer to Extreme Individual Institute. there was a person who ran the website and did all the did the blogging and interacted with the community, ran the email list, and actually triaged anybody who was applying for membership at the EII. You dealt with this guy first, and some of you out there know the name EXE or X. That was me. Under a pseudonym.
Wow. So you were the bulldog.
Yeah. I was the junkyard dog. But basically it was so that, Alan could continue to write the curriculum and put stuff together, and I could put people through the first line of paces. Basically, if you want to use a Fight Club analogy, that was the porch.
Mm-hmm. So you were screening people for their psychopathic potential?
Well, a couple of things about that. Number one, he was being when he used that description, he was being very literal. What he was getting at, and this was from a book called The Psychopath's Bible, which originally was written as a book called Toxic Magic. And one of the reasons that Alan and I hit it off is I read Toxic Magic, and I wrote him. We knew each other through Bob Wilson, Robert Anton Wilson, and I wrote to Alan and said, I get it. This is a great big fucking joke, and I named out all the reasons why I thought it was a joke, and then I said, of course, it's also not a joke, because, and then I listed all the reasons why I thought it wasn't. And if you look at the version that's out now, there's a jacket board by me on the back of the Psychopath's Bible that says, believe everything that you read in this book on second thought. Don't believe anything you read in this book. And I mean that quite literally.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people went, oh, yeah, classic Matheny. But I mean that quite literally, because it's a joke and it's not a joke. Because what Psychopath's Bible is getting at, first of all, is in identifying the definition. Most people, when they use the term psychopath, they misuse it.
Mm-hmm.
What they really are trying to refer to is a sociopath.
Right.
If you look at the pure definition of a psychopath, really what a psychopath is somebody who doesn't go along just to get along. They don't care that there's all these rules and conventions around them that say they can't do certain things. If they feel like they should do those things, they do them.
Right.
If they feel like they shouldn't do things that they're supposed to do, they don't do them. And that is the classic definition of a psychopath. Therefore, I would define myself as a psychopath. I would define you as one.
Just don't put it on your immigration report.
Exactly. However, because most people misuse the term psychopath and they think it means crazy guy who's going to eat my liver with fava beans.
Mm-hmm. Which is what some people do when they do whatever the hell they want.
That is what some people do. However, what Alan was really after in putting the Extreme Individual Institute together was in attracting a certain type of individual who had potential but was probably feeling lost and, depending on how you want to look at it, was channeling that potential into areas that were not going to benefit those people personally at all. They were going to end up in jail or something worse, drug addicted or, whatever. So, what we did in putting the EII together was we put a face on it that would attract certain types of individuals. And the reason I was screening people is because there's lots of types that get attracted to the EII,
mm-hmm.
That are people that, that we don't feel are redeemable or necessarily intelligent enough or self-aware enough to really go through or benefit from anything that we could do for them.
Mm. I don't want to necessarily sidetrack away from EII, but I can't resist asking this question. I know that you did a sort of alternate reality game prank around the 4Pi, the Process Church, and you basically put an ad for serial killers at a fake website and got quite a lot of feedback. So,
I got some disturbing email.
Right. But I couldn't resist sort of pointing out the parallels here.
Well, yes and no. In the case of 4P, I wasn't screening anybody for anything. What I was after was I was playing with the concept of the boogeyman.
Mm-hmm.
It came to me just after I read Lavinda's trilogy, and I can't remember right off the top of my head what it is, but he just recently wrote this trilogy, and it was all it was all that whole mythos about Manson and Berkowitz and 4P and all that kind of stuff. And I knew people that actually were members of the original Process Church of the Final Judgment. And, you know, they were very offended by that stuff, because that's not what they were about at all. They were hippies, basically. And I also went ahead and read some of the material that that was referenced in that would be like Maury Terry's Ultimate Evil and these kind of things. And I was just blown away by, you know, the sheer stupidity of some of the, you know, the leaps of logic that were made to put this theory together. And then I went out on the internet and started looking around and saw how many people were just, you know, quoting this as if it were the reality. And so I said, well, you know, the only thing that's missing here is the visibility of this so-called 4PI organization, which was supposedly a spinoff from the original Process Church of the Final Judgment. And the whole place that 4PI came from was, there was a guy who was captured in Santa Cruz with a couple of human fingers, bones in his pocket, and, you know, eventually it was found out that he had killed a couple people and he'd cannibalized them. And when he was asked why he did it, he said he was some member of some super secret organization called 4PI.
Right.
That was all tied back into the Process Church and the Final Judgment and all this. And then it just became this whole palaver of things that, you know, that tied Manson and Berkowitz and Zodiac and all, you know, and now the smiley face killer, supposedly smiley face killer things out there. And tied it all together, and, you know, I looked at it and I said, the only thing missing here is a target. You know, if there was such an organization as 4PI, what if it had a website that was recruiting? And it doesn't have to say we're looking for serial killers, because it never said that.
Right.
All it has to say is that we are 4PI, and, you know, we're looking for members, and give contact information for all intents and purposes, and that's all it was. Mm. And what came through was equal parts conspiracy theorists writing to the website to say that if and when they found us, they were going to kill us. Mm-hmm. And a bunch of very confused, disaffected youth, mostly boys. From what I could gather, they were probably in their teens to 20s. Most of them into like black metal and that kind of stuff. Who'd always been looking for the mysterious 4PI, and now that they'd found them, they wanted to join. Mm-hmm. That was it.
So what was the time frame with that experiment as compared to when you were the bulldog for EII?
I did 4P. When did I do 4P? 2 years ago?
Yeah, so it was after.
Yeah, it was after. It was after.
Because, I mean, they're, in a way, they're almost identical, you could say, but what one was for real and the other was a prank. But in both cases, you were a secret, well, not exactly a secret society, but whatever, a group, a cult, whatever you want to call it, looking for recruits. And then based on what people perceived you to be, they came to you with those expectations, right?
Yeah, that was partly it. I would say that the in the EII, I get... I do get a lot of people that, you know, probably aren't EII material yet, but they're not what I would consider complete, I don't know what you would call it, but they definitely are not of the quality of the people that I got from the 4PI site. the letters I was reading from the 4PI people that were writing in that wanted to join, I was like, I'm really glad these people don't know who I really am.
Right. Well, you don't think they might come to EII?
If they did, I would spot them in a second. Right. But, you know.
But did you get people in those early days? Did you get people responding saying, "Oh, I'm a psychopath. I can join."
You know, we did, and I put together. And this is the other thing that was, you know, if I wanted it to be, it could make me very disappointed in human nature. When I put together Toxic Mail, you know, that's when it was a free-for-all, and there was a couple hundred people that were on that mailing list. And I discovered very quickly that there was like, you know, not the majority, but there was a subset of people who actually did read Psychopath's Bible, but actually took it literally and thought that it was a license to be an asshole. Mm-hmm. And that's what they thought. They meant, oh, run amok, do whatever you want, piss on the carpet, you know, and then they took it as that's what it meant.
Mm-hmm.
They did not get the fact that it was very tongue-in-cheek. They didn't get that at all.
Okay. So it'd be like somebody reading Matrix Warrior and then going out and...
Exactly. 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 That's a very good analogy. It would be like that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there was like a group of people that I was just astounded that they didn't see through the fact that, you know, everything that was in Psychopath's Bible was not saying that you should do this, but rather telling you how people do things so that you can know what's being done to you. Mm-hmm. But that it was done in Alan's typical tongue-in-cheek style, because he was a prank. He was a joker. He was the trickster.
So how much is trickery a part of the EII, or was it in those days?
It wasn't at all, actually. The EII itself, like I said, there was a veneer to it, which talked about, that we looked and acted and sounded a certain way from the outside, that we would attract a certain type of individual. Mm. And that was probably the only trickery to it. But once you were triaged, and if you looked like somebody who was really honestly trying to, you know, put your hand on your own rudder, then, you know, you were treated with utmost respect, and you were given, and Alan did all of this. You were given lots of care, lots of attention, and you were treated very seriously.
And was it all, together in person, done in person?
A lot of it was. If you could, he preferred that if you could come show up in person, that you show up in person. Mm. There was body work involved, you know, some Reikian therapy stuff, and... there was a lot of stuff that was involved, and it was a real program.
And it was done in groups.
And it was done as either individually or in small groups. Just recently, there's been a group of people that contacted me from the original group that said, you know, Alan's gone, and I was right in the middle of my training. You know, what happened? And then I was contacted by a person who told me that he wanted to put together, you know, a new EII. And I said, what does that mean? And so we talked, and it turned out that he really just wanted to reboot the Extreme Individual Institute. So I contacted, some people that I knew that were involved in the original group, and not everybody, but some of the people came back. And we've decided that we're going to reboot it. We're going to be working with Falcon, not outside of Falcon, but with Alan's old partner, Nick, and his wife, Linda, and putting the curriculum back together and putting some programs back together. And I'm probably going to lead a group here in Los Angeles. And there's Garrett and Nick are going to lead some Nick Powell are going to lead some groups up in Portland to start, and then we'll probably may put together a New York group. I think there's somebody who wants to put a New York group together. Hmm.
So the information that's at Christopher Hyatt's site now about EII, is that up to date?
No, that's actually, I just put that back up. Nick, when I got contacted by these people and I said, oh yeah, let's do that. I contacted Nick and I said, I still have all the files from Alan's site, because after he died, they took the site down. Mm-hmm. But I still had the site backed up on a DVD here, because I was, like I said, I was the guy that did it. And I said, why don't I put that back online, and then we'll go through and we'll review it, and we'll update it as it probably, I think it says on the site that we're going to update it. We'll do a revision, and we'll put together some new curriculum packages, because before he died, Alan had actually written a couple of new things to use in EII curriculum. And so we've got, stuff that wasn't publicly released at the time of his death that we can put together. And I don't know if there was a series that we used to write together called the Black Books. Mm-hmm. After Alan passed away, just this year, I put together the last Black Book called Omega. I was the one that put it together with Nick. And I brought in a couple of the old EII members to write for it. And we brought out some unpublished information that was Alan's writings that he had written for Black Books before he died.
So could you describe more or less the structure of the curriculum for EII engagement?
It has to do with the individual, and that's why we kind of do triage, is we try to figure out what the knowledge base is of somebody and kind of what they're looking for. Mm. and what they already know and what processes they've already been through. And then it's actually, it's a spiral curriculum, which means that it's tailored to where the individual is in the process, not the other way around.
Right.
So it's not a linear system where you just take them and you go, here's book one, here's book two. But actually you audit the individual, and I'm not being a Scientologist when I say that. No. It's, but, you know, Scientology borrowed the term audit and pretty much have ruined it for anybody. But yeah. But you do audit the individual, and then you you figure out where they are in the process, and then you put them into the spiral curriculum at the place where they need to be.
Okay.
And you move them through it. So it has to do with, basic body awareness. It has to do with discovery and release of trauma. And it has to do with, the process, as we used to call it, was putting your own hand on your own rudder, which is to divine, through this undoing process to get to a point where you can divine what it is that you really want to do once you've discarded yourself of what the situationist would have called manufactured desires.
All right.
So that's the process.
So... And how does a group get formed then?
Right now, I'm letting people form groups who, actually are people that came from the original group. So if somebody from the original group, and there's not a lot of us, but somebody from the original administrative part of the group want to form a node, they can, they just do it with us. And if somebody wanted to kind of ad hoc put one together, it's on a person to person basis. I mean, if it was somebody like you, I'd put a conference call together with some of the people. And I think that somebody like you, or I'm not saying that's what you want to do. I'm saying, like, if it were somebody like you, then, we would have a conversation and we would see where it went.
Mm-hmm.
We would entertain the possibility, is what I'm saying.
So, but I mean, as far as group work, individuals working together in a group, that happens too, presumably.
Yeah. So if there are people, like one of the Portland groups was literally just a bunch of people that wanted to get together and start to explore, talk about, and discover the undoing process. After Nick Pell, my friend Nick Pell did a talk at ESOZone last year. On radical undoing, which, and then he actually said, I'm part of the new EII and blah, blah, blah. And it got a lot of people very interested. And so they contacted me and said, we'd like to put a group together. And I contacted everybody else and said, hey, they want to put a group together. And so, the people like Garrett and Nick who are up in Portland kind of oversee that group.
So the group is formed, and then that's it. You wouldn't have new arrivals entering into a group once it has been formed.
No, it's up to the group. If they want to allow new arrivals, they can. Oh. If they feel like it's going to be disruptive to their individual process, then they can say no. They can shut it off if they want to. But it depends on what the group is doing, what the intention of the group is.
Right.
It might be disruptive if there's a. If there's a set course that they want to go through, if they say we want to do these three things specifically, it might be disruptive for somebody to come into the middle of that. So they could say we're not going to let anybody into this particular group or during this working.
Right, because presume potentially there's an integration that would occur within the group.
What do you mean?
Well, as you can probably guess, I'm curious, like the parallels with Sweater, where it does match and where it diverges. And one of the things with Sweater that's been a dilemma, if you will, is that a group that came together and began to share their narratives and undo themselves within that group, there was an integration that occurred because as those layers of identity armor were deconstructed and laid down, then there was more and more intimacy that was occurring between the separate psyches. So potentially what was happening was like this what we call the metasoul, which is not too fanciful a term, but there's a collective psyche that was occurring.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what the original process church used to call the omega mind.
Okay.
What they discovered when they were going through radical undoing together as groups is that there was this collective, what Burroughs and Geisen called it, the third mind. Mm-hmm. It was like this kind of this meta mind that would pop up, and, over the top of a group that had been going through a lot of processing together.
Mm-hmm. So it's a mini collective unconscious that becomes mm-hmm. conscious of itself through the... So is that something that you observed or factored into the EII?
It's something that I've observed. There's not been enough groups that that we've had to factor it in or account for it yet. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if there ever will be. So the EII has always been kind of a small, for lack of a better term, elitist kind of thing. And it's definitely not something that we're thinking about franchising or anything like that. Because we're trying to, at all costs, we're trying to avoid the pitfalls of religion and all the trappings that go with that and the problems that go with it. So I don't know if that's something that we'll continue to observe, but I did notice that in personal groups that I was involved in, small groups of three and up to 10, that, over a period of time, if you were doing intense work over 3, 5, 8 weeks, that, you would observe this phenomena. But since I was already conscious of that phenomena, I was, I could explain to everybody what was going on, and it was kind of a novelty.
Because that would also be where the cult-like energy might creep in. If people, because this has happened at Sweater, people get a sense of this group mind moving in, and because I, as the leader, I embody it more noticeably than others, then I've been accused of being Charles Manson and Jim Jones.
Welcome to the club! Yeah, I'm in that club, but the intention is not to, again, it's not to be a Charles Manson, and it's not to start a frickin' religion.
Uh-huh.
It's not to be a guru, and it's not to start an ashram or any of those things. It's the polar opposite of that, actually. And in some cases, the people that come through, the NEII are people that are escaping from those things in their past and trying to figure out, how to integrate that and how to, if nothing else, how to deprogram themselves from some of the programming.
Right, I was going to say, that's the essence, presumably, of EII, as it is of Sweater, although we don't use the term, it is deprogramming, finding those implants, as it were, and isolating them and not digging them out or anything. That doesn't seem to be necessary, as once you see them, they sort of fall away of their own accord. But then the tendency is that, because if somebody's letting go of that, those structures of belief, then they're going to cling on to or try and assemble new structures based on the ideas that are prevalent within that group, within that morphic field. And so, I do have a philosophy, if you will, and that is intrinsic, as it is presumably EII. There's a perspective that presumably that shapes all of the exercises and all the interactions, in that it's a particular focus. Have you found that that you have to be aware of that danger, that people will cling to that?
Yeah, like I said, I talked about the people that came on board who thought it was a license to be an asshole, and there was another kind of subset of people who came on board who thought that this was, and most of these people did not make it past the porch. I got to be honest with you, because I'm pretty good at spotting these people. Because over the years, I've had people try to be my follower, and I don't want followers. I have no interest whatsoever in being a guru. And so I've learned to spot the signs pretty quickly. But there were people that got past me here and there that, literally their whole thing was that they thought they were joining a cult.
Yeah, and they wanted.
That's what they thought they were doing. They wanted it. There's a subset of people out there. Now, you're going to be as shocked as I was when I came to this realization. There are a whole subset of people out there who want somebody to tell them what to do.
No, I'm not shocked.
It's not an unconscious thing either.
No, well, yeah, I guess it does become shocking if they actually just brazenly admit it. That's kind of unusual. But what would really be disturbing and surprising is if they came to me. Then I would know I was sending out some very unclear signals.
No, you don't have to be sending out unclear signals sometimes. It's even if you're sending out clear signals, you have to have a clear receiver, and the clear sometimes it's the receiver that's not clear. You know, what they're saying in their head when you're telling them something, this is not a cult. They're in their head. There's a tape loop that's going, well, that's what he's saying, right. But what he really means.
That means it really is a cult. That's what exactly. They say. I'm not a guru. Well, I figured that out pretty quick, that if I don't want people to think I'm a guru, the best way is to say I am a guru. Because if you say you're not a guru, then that's it. That just clinches it. I knew it.
I knew it. He's denying it. That's what they all do.
So we're almost at the second hour, so I thought maybe we could just finish off by trying to loop it back to the beginning, which is transmedia storytelling. And I'm curious, because at the Hyatt site, this sort of refers to writing one's, there's one thing specific that struck me, which was writing one's autobiography in the third person. So then how much is transmedia storytelling an intrinsic part of EII, would you say?
Alan and I had differences about the methodology of transmedia storytelling. They weren't like, you know, vicious differences, but if you read the interview that I did with him in Gulch Arc 1 or 2, can't remember anymore, but it's also on the EII, the Kromos Kids, and he talks about having reservations about my methods from a storytelling perspective, because it's too easy for, you know, an unsavory character to hijack the narrative. And I have to agree with him that that is a possibility. And I have seen it done. However, that doesn't put me off of the methodology completely. As far as how much does it have to do with the actual working inside the EII, I would say the transmedia part, probably not so much. The storytelling part, there's nothing that says when you build and tell your myth that it has to be via the transmedia storytelling method, although you could use that method. If you want to just write it down, or if you want to perform it, or however you want to do it, you know, that's how you can do it.
But uncovering the mythic narrative is a part of EII, then.
Yeah, absolutely.
Wow. And is that, you mentioned the trauma, releasing trauma, so presumably there's also what I've called existential detective work of actually finding out what those traumas might be.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the first thing you have to do is you have to locate them, then you have to identify them before you can release them, right?
Right.
And so that is existential detective work right there. And so without calling it the same thing, in essence, we are doing the same thing, which is we're looking for, you know, obvious trauma points in somebody's life that are being held, you know, both in their mind and in their body, because we take kind of a Reichian view of that. And we facilitate the release. You know, I mean, obviously the individual has to do the release themselves ultimately, but anything we can do to facilitate that is what we do.
Like holding a space in which it's safe for them to let that stuff in. No?
You know, that's a big part of it. And then also, you know, one of the things that I'm really, the part that I'm really big on is not just building the safe spaces, not just building the safe space, but that is important, but also helping the individual get to a point where they feel safe in any space.
Right.
That's the part that I see a lot of workings, you know, especially this new age stuff. They don't really take care of that part of it. They just try to get you to a safe space and then
leave you in it.
Yeah, basically, it's like that thing in Fight Club. You know, go back to my safe space. Go back to my cave. Go back to my cave. Mm-hmm. That's kind of where they leave people is in that situation where if they ever need to be in a safe space, they have to get back to that safe space. They can't just, you know, feel safe wherever they are.
Right. It's like the parable of the man who goes to the top of a mountain and meditates for 10 years and then attains total inner peace, and then goes down to market and gets into a fight with the first person that he bumps into.
Yeah, it's like that. Well, I mean, you know, so much behavior is based on fear, right? In this culture. So if you find that a lot of aberrant behavior that's coming out of you is actually fear reaction, then maybe one of the solutions to that is to remove the fear.
Mm-hmm. So is there a progression from the trauma discovery and release to the uncovering of the mythic narrative, or do they occur simultaneously, or how does that work?
Well, they occur simultaneously, but then there's also, again, there's the constant awakening process. So your personal narrative when you come in is not going to be the same right. personal narrative when you leave.
Because those areas of trauma, the memorable events, as Castaneda calls them in the Source of Scrapbook, they're often, anything that was traumatic to us would have imprinted us, and so they're like key developments in the narrative, just as when the hero gets wounded or, you know,
yeah.
falls off the ship or whatever it is that happens that leads to a whole shift in his perspective. So then the more you uncover the trauma and release it, actually writing the narrative, this is what I'm immersed in myself right now, is writing about my brother and the past trauma there, is that discovering it gives me something to write about, but then by writing about it, I'm also seeing it in a new way, and it's part of the process of making it impersonal, of making it part of this narrative, and that's how I'm actually releasing the trauma, is by writing about it.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of it, and then that's why I said your personal narrative will change as you release some of those points. You know, not to get off the subject too much, but I didn't even realize who your brother was till it dawned on me the other day that I've got his book on my shelf. I haven't read it. Somebody gave it to me.
Holy shit.
I went, oh, that's him.
Small universe.
Yeah, well, somebody gave it to me and said, you ought to read this. It was kind of interesting. And I'm like, oh, okay. And then I put it on my shelf and I never read it. But so I couldn't tell you what it's about, but I do own it.
A Dandy in the Underworld.
Yeah, the title caught my eye. And then I said, you know, I don't think I want to read this.
Yeah. Well, it was weird. Might have been a good call, but now your curiosity is going to be piqued.
I probably still won't read it, to be honest with you. I kind of get through osmosis what it is. Mm. And this is nothing against your brother. I don't know him.
No, please.
I'm just saying that, you know, those books were coming out for a while. A couple years ago, they were very trendy. My Life of Excess. And, it's only so many of those I can look at. And then I go, oh, well.
Well, it's not a mythic narrative. I mean, that I have to say. Well, I guess I would love to continue. I was actually dying to go into a whole new area, but we're at the end of our second hour now, so we should probably just round it up and save it for another day, you think?
Yeah, you know, what we can do is we can do this again, and maybe we'll just do another hour or two, and then you can put it on your show and I'll put it on my show.
The only catch there is that my show will be over by then, because this is the second.
You really are. You're going to fold the tent, huh?
This is the penultimate episode of this season, anyway. Yeah, who knows what will transpire in the future. But, yeah, I'm all about folding up tents and moving on. That's what makes me the vagabond.
No, that's good.
Like I say, I don't want to embark on another hour, but I was really struck by how EII and Sweater seem to have actually come into being in a way that was organic and spontaneous, and so there are these very precise parallels between them, and yet I'm guessing, because I didn't actually work out the form or direction or structure of Sweater myself, I just started it and it evolved spontaneously, and then I mapped that and then I took credit for it.
Yeah, that's kind of what happened with EII too. It was just like, you know, Alan being the head of Vulcan Press, he obviously was contacted by a lot of people for a lot of reasons, but he began to notice an emerging pattern that there was a certain type of individual that was contacting him over and over again, which was, you know, these people that looked like, when you got to know them, they were intelligent, they were, a lot of times they were artistic, they were talented, you know, they were personable, However, because they didn't quite, they were square pegs in a round hole when it came to fitting into the rest of society, a lot of times they, you know, they were also, when they were young, they were, you know, in jail or in trouble or, you know, those kind of things. And so this was ultimately what they weren't learning was they weren't learning coping skills. And they also, a lot of them would have trauma. They would come from abusive backgrounds or something like that. And so, you know, there was all this potential that was basically getting squandered. And unlike his, I can feel him from the other side. He's pointing his finger at me now, but I'm going to tell on him. Unlike his public persona, or at least the perception that was out there of Alan, he had a big heart and he really did care about people. And this really, meeting these boys and girls that were, you know, I call them that because they were in their early 20s, a lot of them, but, you know, these young people with all this potential that, you know, were basically just rudderless and didn't have anybody to give them any guidance. And because they were, not because they were, you know, below average, but because they were above average, they were being punished. And they weren't, they really didn't have an outlet. So, you know, he wanted to do something to help them. It's that simple.
Well, there's one other thing we have in common, Sweater and EII. We both have these unwieldy names.
All right, Jason, I'm going to jump here. It was great talking to you, as usual.
Yeah, likewise. Thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, we'll stay in touch.